We have fewer in attendance. Most people go down to the beach. But in spite of this, I keep my promise. And by talking about the two pillars of modern ethics, according to my promise, I am going to elaborate a little bit ethics of personality, the question which we have discussed yesterday after Katie's presentation. Now, first of all, when I speak about two pillars of modern ethics, I have to ask the question, what is modern ethics? Obviously, even today, even nowadays, a person is born in the concrete environment, and in spite of the positions of all cultural critics, every environment has its own ethical, moral norms, rules, requirements, codes, and so on. So you cannot be born in a world in which your mother and father and teacher, etc., would not tell you what is the right thing to do, what is the wrong thing to do. There are so-called concrete norms in every human environment. I think that no one is even now born into a limbo, that is, into a place where there are no norms and rules at all, where everything has to be invented. No one is thrown into a limbo. Everyone is thrown into an environment when one is confronted with certain kind of moral requirement, maybe sometimes contradictory moral requirement, different at home, different in the school, and so forth. And in this case, if they are different, then somehow she must out what kind of rules she wants to follow, whether she likes one rule or does not. It reminds me of our secretary, our dear Claire Martin, who as a child was enrolled in religious instruction in the Southern school in the United States. And at the first day of instruction, religious instruction, the teacher told her that all Catholics go to hell. And Claire went home and told the mother, I don't want to go anymore to religious instruction because a Catholic friend, I do not want her to go to hell. So you are, and then the parents allowed her not to go to this religious instruction. So even as a child, you are confronted with certain kind of strong or weak, narrow or dense moral norms, and you cannot help to obey one, impinge the other, and somehow find out your way among them. When I speak about modern ethics, I speak about the kind of ethics which must be assumed to be common, shared, in all concrete worlds of concrete norms and rules in the modern world. That is, modern ethics is the ethical minimum, the moral minimum, which can also be described as maximum, as we later see, which must be shared, or is to be shared, or is factually shared by very different people who live in different concrete moral environments. One normally distinguishes between concrete norms and abstract norms and certain universal norms. The concrete norms are basically commands or prescriptions for action. You should greet this and that, you should accept that all Catholics go to hell, that these are concrete norms. They are abstract norms which do not tell you exactly what you ought to do or what you ought to feel, what is the proper thing to do, what is the proper thing to feel, but give you certain orientation, abstract orientation, be honest, don't lie, don't specify what lying means, be courageous, etc., etc. These are very abstract norms, and you can follow these norms according to your own interpretation of the norms. When I speak about modern ethics, I give an insight into certain kind of requirements, or rather procedures, which are not necessarily formal, which are shared by, I repeat, by everyone who is born in a modern world, in a modern environment. Now, in the modern world, in general, there are no firm fundaments. Certainly, in one or the other concrete culture, there are certain fundaments. For example, the teacher of our dear Claire Martin, who informed her that all Catholics go to hell, she should have had, he obviously had, certain firm fundaments. These fundaments was fundamentalist Protestantism of a certain kind, and she was very firm that everything what she believes to be right is right, everything what she believes to be true is true. But the whole world there has no fundament. For example, the parents of Claire understood very well why she rejects this position, and the dear Catholic then, whom she never wanted to go to hell, was very pleased that she shared her worry about going to hell and so on and so forth. That is a pluralistic universe as far as concrete norms are concerned, and this pluralistic universe is not founded. That there is no common foundation of a pluralistic universe, the modern universe has no concrete foundations. I expressed myself many times in the following way, that the modern world is grounded on freedom, and freedom is a foundation which does not found. Let me unpack this sentence. The modern world was born in a way, together with the slogan, all men are born free, and all are equally provided by the Creator with reason, conscience, and they have all the right of pursuits of happiness, liberty, and so on and so forth, as the American Declaration of Independence suggests. Now, in that is, people accept this, accept it as taken for granted, and you accept this as taken for granted, it means, even if you do not know it, that you are void of fundaments. Because if everyone is born free, then freedom is the foundation of the world, and I repeat, freedom is a foundation which does not fund for the simple reason that if you are free, you are free doing this and that, you are free to choose this and that, you are free to accept that all Catholics go to hell, and you are free to reject that all Catholics go to hell, you are free to accept one form of life and reject it, and accept another form of life and reject it. That is, you have a free choice, not between actions, because as old as civilization, but you have free choice between the different concepts of the good. And there are different concepts of the good, and you have free choice between the different concepts of good, and the moment you have a free choice between different concepts of the good, your world has no foundation. Because there is a foundation if there is only one single, unified, absolute conception of the good. If there are many conceptions of the good and you can choose among them, then your world has no foundation, it remains unfounded, and this is why I said freedom is a foundation which does not form. Of course, there is no morality without any kind of foundation, because as Aristotle knew it and everyone knows it, you need an arche to which you return in your demonstration, and you need also an arche to which you return in your different kind of action. So if you think about it rationally, whether this action is right or wrong, you can explain yourself why is it right or wrong, and by explaining you go further and further or back and back from one cause to the other cause, etc. At the end you have to stop, because if you do not stop you go ad infinitum. If you don't want to go ad infinitum, you stop, and you must stop by an arche, by a fundamental, final, foundational sentence. Now, everyone is born free is a foundational sentence, but I tell you, this is the kind of foundational sentence which does not found your way of life, because it suggests you that you are free to choose your way of life, and if you are free to choose your way of life, then you need to give or find a foundation to the way of life you have chosen. It's no otherwise. Now that is, I would now use a metaphor and tell the following. The modern world has no solid foundation. Now if you compare the modern world with a house, I would say that it is not firmly based on the earth, on the soil, that there is no cellar there, it's no firmly based. The modern world, however, still has foundations, but these foundations are not absolute foundations. They are those foundations which need to be shared by everyone, whether he has other foundations or no other foundations at all. And this is what I call modern ethics. These are two foundational things, whatever they are, which found modern men totally independent of which, whether they belong to any kind of concrete social or cultural or moral unity or community, or whether they do not belong to any kind of moral community unity at all, if they are totally lonely, if they have no joining or even leaving those communities in which they are born. So I said that the moral modern world is founded on two pillars. You imagine it as a house which would float in the air, float freely on the air. However, because it needs to be founded, it has two pillars. It stands firmly on these two pillars. These two pillars are the foundations of the modern world. The question is, what are these two pillars? Which are these two pillars which found a world which is not founded, which founds a world in which you can accept any conception of the good, and you can choose among different conceptions of the good. What is common among the different conceptions of the good if you speak about modern ethics, only about modern ethics? I said that there are two such pillars. And the modern morality is either founded on two pillars, not on the ground. The pillars are the pillars which, I repeat, needs to be shared by everyone who lives in a modern world and who has a modern foundation of the modern world besides the traditional foundations basically everyone has. Now these two pillars are in my view, first the good person and the other hand the good citizen. It's nothing new about it, because Aristotle said the same, that we have to distinguish between good man and the good citizen. I also say that we have to distinguish between the good person on the one hand, the good citizen on the other hand. So, to express myself differently, the first pillar is the ethics of a good person. The second pillar is the constitution to which a good citizen has to recur, has to return. It is a republican constitution. These are the two pillars. A modern world where these two pillars stand is morally firm, irrespective of the fact how many densely habitated moral systems exist in this world, or whether they exist densely habitated moral system in this world at all. So you can have a republic, and republic you can have different religious communities, you can have atheistic communities, you can have working class movements, you can have feminist movements, totally different kind of movements and groups of people and communities. Each of them have their own conception of the good. But they need to share these two pillars of ethics in order that we can speak about them as communities or groups dwelling in a modern moral world. So I speak about the good person and the good citizen. That is the first pillar, is the decency of modern man. It is here I have to return to the problem of ethics of personality, which was discussed yesterday, but were not really discussed, only pointed at. Let's see the decency of the modern man. As it was mentioned yesterday, and I think also the day before yesterday, that the consciousness of the modern man is the self-consciousness of contingency. Although every person was thrown in the world by accident, they are unaware of it, they are not conscious about it, whereas the modern man is conscious about being a contingent product. That is, this consciousness of contingency is shared basically with everyone who can be described as a modern person. Now this contingency feeling, consciousness, consists of two different aspects. The first aspect I will call a cosmic contingency, the other I would call social contingency. Cosmic contingency was an experience which was already discovered by Pascal, and Pascal said that we are truly born into a world in which we do not know, or at least we cannot answer the question, whether someone put us into this world. who put us into this place, or rather, no one put us into this place. There is no more providence. There are no more providential dispensations. So we feel ourselves entirely lonely under the sun or under the starry sky because no one watches over us. And Pascal drew from this conclusion that we have to make a wager about the existence of God to overcome the feeling of this cosmic contingency. No guardian angels, no one put us in this place, that no one wants to do something with us, no one has a project with us, no one serves any more high purpose, we are just there as products of mere accident. The second kind of contingency, it is social contingency, not moral contingency, social contingency, which develops together with the modern social condition, with the modern condition of social life, namely that we are thrown into a world without being addressed to a concrete stratum or a concrete way of life. In pre-modern worlds, you were thrown into a world as well, but I often compare humans who are thrown into the world with a genetic a priori, which is put in an envelope, but the envelope is addressed. There is an address envelope, you can address the envelope. This a priori goes to the pre-person in Athens, this person who is in this envelope goes to nobleman in Frankfurt, this in the envelope goes to a slave in Rome, and so these are addressed envelopes. We are going there, they are this metaphysical or transcendental postman. The postman distributes his envelope according to their destination. They have a destination and they are distributed according to their destination. But a modern man is someone who is also a genetic a priori, but it is put into an envelope which has no address. That is, it's an unaddressed envelope. And that this poor transcendental postman does not know which is the destiny of this person, because the person is not destined. Nothing is written on the envelope. So he doesn't know the address. So by random are these envelopes distributed, absolutely by random, because the postman gets an envelope which is not addressed, the postman either returns it to the post office, which cannot be done because then the person dies, or randomly distributes the person wherever he goes. This is a very erratic postman, because the distribution is entirely random. Since the envelopes are not addressed, and means that the person has no destination. So what remains there as a possible solution? That the person itself, himself, herself, has to address his or her own envelope. That this is the task of modern men, that they have to address their own envelope, they have to figure out their own destination. So when we spoke about choosing ourselves, I return to this question soon. It means basically addressing the envelope, what we are. Addressing is this is our destination, and because this transcendental postman does not know where to deliver us, they deliver us randomly. We never reach our destination. We are born totally randomly here or there. So we have to address our own envelope, and somehow we have figured out ourselves, our destination. So we have to become ourselves, destine ourselves, so to speak. Which means that the responsibility is for us. Till this moment, there was no responsibility for the individual in this way, because he was thrown into a concrete situation. The obedient transcendental postman delivered this person to its proper destination, and the person had only task to live up to the exigencies of its destination, to become a good slave, to become a decent Athenian citizen, to become a good servant, to become a nice horseman or whatever. So that was the destination. But now you have no destination, you have to choose your destination. It is great responsibility of the individual if you are thrown into freedom to figure out your own destination. This is why modern so frequently emphasize the burden of freedom. The burden is a freedom that you are thrown into the world by random and you have to destine your own, your own envelope. It's basically freedom, but as Sartre said, to be thrown in freedom means to be thrown into nothingness, because the freedom is totally empty. You can use your freedom in order to find your destination, to address your envelope, but it's a terrible burden. You are responsible for your own fate. You are responsible for your own future. No one takes the responsibility out of your hand. No one cares for you. No one commands you. No one tells you anymore exactly what you should do, what you should become. You have to tell it yourself. This is a terrible burden. This is the burden of contingency consciousness. This is how you feel this contingency. Fear of freedom, said Fromm in one of his books. People are trembling because of this. They are afraid of freedom. Or as Kierkegaard says, anxiety. Anxiety, from anxiety you jump into freedom, you leap into freedom, also a metaphor of course. The anxiety of freedom makes you leap into the freedom. To get rid of anxiety, then you are anxious again, you are in this freedom. Now so you are thrown into this, I say, void, where of course there are a lot of different kind of moral prescription for you, but because they are heterogeneous, none of them is final, none of them is ultimate. There is basically a marketplace of norms and rules and communities, and many of them say themselves as final and ultimate, but none of them is ultimate because there are too many of them, so you anyway you have to choose, and not just among them, but basically you have to choose yourself. I come back to this, not those. So this, of course, you can say, and the Enlightenment was very strict in this case. Enlightenment said that, okay, you are thrown in this heterogeneous world of different normative networks, but you have to use your reason, yeah? You have to rationally find out which network is better than the other. So employ your reason. Then you start to employ your reason, and the reason then delegitimates this order. Because no moral order is finally rational. None of this moral order stands to criticism of reason. Because there is always something in what is asked from you, what is commanded for you, which does not stand the test of rationality. You can always say, so why do you do that? Why should I? My father said to the child, you should not eat vanilla ice cream. My child said, why can't I eat vanilla ice cream? Because it is unhealthy. Why is vanilla cream unhealthy? Because it can rot in the heat. But there is no heat here. This vanilla cream cannot be rotten. So you go ad infinitum. I gave you another example, which was a typical moral example, that if a child tortures a cat, why you should not torture a cat? And the child asked the question, why shouldn't I torture a cat? Because he's suffering. The child says, so what? And the parent says, because you would not like to suffer either, so then I don't want to suffer, but why shouldn't the cat suffer? The two things are not linked to each other. And then the father and the mother becomes in the state of despair. How can you explain to the child that you should not torture the cat? You can go on and go on with arguments, and then she will ask again questions. No arguments is the final argument, because you need something. Okay, if you say in old times God had commanded it, that's the final argument, then you understand. But you cannot say that God commanded it, you go on. But even if you say nowadays God commanded it, the child will ask the question whether God exists, and the parent says yes, how do you know? Oh, it goes on ad infinitum. Reason, with the reason there is the problem. Reason can delegitimate all norms and rules, but basically cannot legitimate any of them. So in the Enlightenment we go, and this is a very strict problem formulated many times by the great authors of Enlightenment. Two of them I may now mention. Kant was the frequently mentioned author, Immanuel Kant, who said that pure practical reason commands, you can never ask why. Because if you start to argue, the argument is done by understanding, your argument goes on ad infinitum. He said exactly the same thing what I said. This is why the command of the category imperative is absolute. You cannot ask why. You cannot make an argument. It is not dependent on the argument, because if you start to argue, everything is lost. It goes on ad infinitum. That's Kant. And what Diderot, in the nephew, Rambo's nephew, this beautiful, beautiful dialogue, when Rambo's nephew starts to argue, of course, he's in a way a clown, but a very clever and cynical clown, who, of course, goes on with arguments and arguments why you should not behave decently. You have all the reasons not to behave decently. At the end, what does the Diderot, who talks to him, say? Says, he says, I am an honest man, and your world is not mine. That's it. I am an honest man, and your world is not mine. This is what Diderot says. He cannot argue. All arguments are basically refused. The only argument is, which is not an argument, I am an honest man. What I am, this is it, and I cannot go further. I don't answer you anymore. I am an honest man, and your morality, your conception is not mine. That's the final thing in Rambo's nephew. So in the Enlightenment, they knew, they saw it, that there is a problem here. Reason can delegitimate and can say all the norms and rules are just irrational, with the sole exception that to universal values, freedom and life. But we know that freedom is a value. Freedom is something which does not offer you foundation. Life does not offer either foundation. Anyway, life and freedom are in constant conflict. You here you are, and you need a kind of foundation, but you do not find a foundation. This is where so-called ethics of personality comes in. When I say ethics of personality, I emphasize many times, I have not invented these ethics. Basically, when you make an observation in the modern world, decent persons, I describe decent persons. When I describe decent persons, I must know that basically they are the embodiment. Modern decent persons that also have a modern ethics, they are the embodiment of ethics of personality. When I describe now the procedure, that is basically a philosophical game. I philosophically want to tell you what does it mean to become a decent person. But when you ask me how do I know that someone is a decent person, I say, I know it because I see. Because good persons exist, I look around, good persons are this, I see these good persons, this is the ultimate argument. But Kant had no better argument than I, then because he was asked, how do you know that someone obeyed the category imperative, or at least approximately obeyed the category imperative? He also said, because the good will shines like a jewel, because everyone sees it. And his answer was exactly the same thing. Good will shines as a jewel. Now goodness shines as a jewel. Everyone sees it. The question is not whether people are good, whether they are good people, because we all know that they are good people. The question is, how can you be good in a modern world? How can you be good in a modern world where the strict words with foundations of norms and rules are no more present? There is a plurality of the moral world, where there is a possibility to choose the concept of the good for your own. You have even the right to choose your concept of the good. Now, how are then good persons possible? How can they become good? Not why is someone good, because this question cannot be asked anyway. That how can a person be good? How is possible that good persons exist? This is the question I ask, and I give here a philosophical answer in ethics of personality. A personality, the ethics of personality, I repeat, is basically the ethics of modern men who choose the concept of good of their own, who give themselves their own fundament, who address their own envelope. Now, everyone who addresses his own envelope is following an ethical personality. Now, what happens if someone does not address one's envelope? You know that this transcendental postman now throws these envelopes on the street, everyone can pick up one because they are not addressed. Now, those who do not address their envelope, and that's Kierkegaard's answer, others will decide for him. And he will never decide on his own. That is, he will not be autonomous, not even to a degree, because others will decide instead of him. Others will decide for him. He will be a puppet for the decision of others. This is no one wanted to accept among the men of enlightenment. This is one Kant said, that if you start to go on with arguments, basically end up into puppet theater. You will be tied to sticks, yeah, and you will be pulled and pushed like in a ticket, because everything is about cause and effect, reason and effect. You are in a puppet theater. That's why you need autonomy, you need something which cannot be pushed and pulled, like in a puppet theater. So basically everyone knew this problem. So either you address yourself, your envelope, or others will decide for you. I would not say that the majority of people do belong to those people whose envelope is only exclusively addressed by others. I think a world is a very pluralistic world, and a pluralistic world than not entirely heteronomous people. That is, extreme heteronomy is as rare and as exceptional as total autonomy. Mostly people are in between. My question is not whether a person can be entirely totally autonomous, and what does it mean if a person is honest, decent, which might also mean, not necessarily means, that the autonomy is basically overwhelming in his or her personality. And not heteronomy, not others decide for him, but basically he or she will address his or her envelope. I use here the metaphor of Søren Kierkegaard, that to become what you are means that you have chosen yourself. You choose yourself. You choose yourself. It is not a matter of will, the self-choice. You choose yourself. You choose yourself, and after you have chosen yourself, in a leap, this is a leap, then you start to become what you are. So, what you are already are. Why is that a leap? Because if it were not a leap, not just talking with Kierkegaard, but talking also with Kant, it would be determined. If something is not a leap, it is determined. And then we get back to the puppet theater. The leap means that I destine myself with this leap, that I am not determined. I am not determined by my past. I am undetermined. I am not a puppet in a puppet theater. Not others will choose for me. I address my own envelope. And the moment I address my own envelope, but how long this moment lasts is another matter, then I begin to become what I have chosen myself to be, that I become to develop, and no more pushed, I am pulled. Because you are destined yourself, then you are pulled. You are pulled by the telos. But I tell the telos is inbuilt. The telos is not that, it's not that my life has a goal, I want to be prime minister, or life, my goal of my life, that I will want to be a university professor, I want to be a sailor, and it's not this. Telos is inbuilt. It's inbuilt. You are pulled by what is inside, and you are not pushed. So there is no cause-effect relationship, no efficient cause, but the formal cause. The formal cause, what you choose yourself to be, and the telos, that is the telos as cause, and causa finalis, as the Latins call it, this is which pulls you, the causa finalis in you. Sartre expressed this, that man is a project, yeah? And we're projecting ourselves in the future. We project ourselves as we are. We project ourselves entirely. Now, what does it mean that I choose myself? How can I overcome determination? This is the question. How can I avoid to be a puppet? That was the question of Diderot. That was the question of Kant. That was the question of Kierkegaard. This is the same question. How can we avoid to be puppets? And then the story goes as follows. I choose myself, but what does it mean that I choose myself? I choose myself as a doctor, as a philosopher, as a decent person. Later on I talk about it, I can choose myself this or that. But the main thing is that I choose myself fully. I choose myself means I choose my character, I choose my psychology, I choose my own psychological shortcomings, I choose my traumas, I choose my parents, I choose my country, I choose the time of my birth, I choose the place of my birth, I choose everything, everything is chosen. And I say, this is what I am. And as I am, I become this and this because I chose myself this and this. Now, it means that there is no external determination, only internal determination. If you choose everything what you are, then you do not have any external determination, no puppet theater, because every determination will be internal, because everything what you are is chosen. I have chosen my father, I have chosen my mother, I have chosen my country, I have chosen the place of my birth, the time of the birth, I have chosen the customs, I have chosen everything in which I was till this present moment brought up. Nothing is external, everything is internal. That Kierkegaard beautifully said, I repent myself back into the past. It's a beautiful expression, I repent. Repent has two meanings, repentance, yeah? And I go back, repent. I repent myself into the past, says Kierkegaard. Now, to cut a long story short, the choice of the self can be different. That is, this existential choice, which is always a leap, because it cannot be determined, not to be pulled by the string, it is an internal choice. I distinguish between two kinds of choices. You can distinguish between many types of choices, but I choose the simple path to distinguish between two types of self-choices. I said we can choose ourselves under the category of difference, and we can choose ourselves under the category of the universal. If you choose ourselves such and such, I choose myself a lawyer, I choose myself a doctor, I choose myself a philosopher, then I choose yourself under the category of difference. Because all these kinds of choices are different from all the other kinds of choices. But when I choose myself a philosopher, I become, this moment on, I become what I already am. I become a philosopher. And if I choose myself as a philosopher and start to become a philosopher, I choose myself as a painter and start to become, but I anyway be a painter, later on I cannot tell myself, you didn't become a painter because your father was so unpleasant, or because you were not born in New York but you were in Girona and you have no much less possibility to become a painter. You cannot say, because you have chosen Girona, you have chosen your father, and you said, as I am, I become what I chose myself to be, namely a painter. There is no excuse, there is no external excuse. You can choose yourself, this is the main thing which I want to discuss today, you can choose yourself as a decent, honest person. You can say, I am a decent, honest person, I choose myself a decent person, and I will become what I am, namely a decent person. And again, I choose everything. I choose my country, the time of my birth, I choose my psychological problems, I choose my bodily features, I choose my ugliness, I choose my beauty, I choose everything. And as I am, I will become a decent person because I am a decent person. So, if you do something which is not all right, you cannot say anymore, not anymore, that I did it because my father has beaten me up, because my parents were divorced, and I had a terrible childhood, or because I was spoiled and I had a spoiled childhood, or because a friend of mine did that in this to me, because I was born in the wrong place. You cannot say that. because you choose yourself as you are with everything what you are. You said, I am a decent person, and then you become what you are, namely a decent person. There is no excuse. Which is a very simple thing. You take responsibility. You take absolute responsibility for what you become, because you are responsible for what you are. Then you are responsible for what you become. This is when you choose the effort under the category of the universal. That's why universal, it's expression is very simple, because everyone can choose oneself as a decent person, and choosing yourself a decent person is the least risky, because in order to become what you are, you do not need talents. That is, an existential failure is very unlikely. Existential failure is not unlikely if you choose yourself under the category of difference. You can choose yourself as a painter, and it can turn out that you never become a good painter. Yeah? But you can always become a good person. You may become maybe a bad philosopher, but you can always become a good person. That is universal, because it's accessible for everyone. Everyone can remain true, can live up to his responsibilities. In the case of choosing oneself under the category of the universal, choosing oneself as a decent person. And then you become what you are, namely a decent person. This is what I call ethics of personality. Now, what does it mean to be a decent person? That's the first question you ask. And to this question, I said that we do not need to invent here anything. And we only look at the tradition. That it is described many times in the tradition, what does it mean to be a decent person. I refer to the discussion or the controversy between Socrates and Trasimachus, or Socrates and Callicles, and say there was a discussion whether it's better to suffer or to commit injustice, whether it's better to suffer the wrong or wrong another person. And Socrates said it is better to suffer injustice than commit injustice, and Callicles and Trasimachus said the opposite. It is better to commit injustice than to suffer injustice, and both had good arguments. Here I come with the arguments. Both the arguments of Trasimachus, arguments of Socrates were equally good arguments. There's no different argument. In addition, Trasimachus and Callicles could even rely on empirical evidence, because they said, look around, what do people do if they come to it? Normally choose rather to commit injustice than to suffer injustice. You are crazy. People don't do that. So arguments are equally good, empirical evidences rather on the side of Trasimachus and Callicles. So I cannot, this sentence that it is better to suffer injustice than to commit injustice, it can be proven and can be disproven, so you can say it is true and it is untrue. I cannot do anything with these sentences. But I can say, and this is the only thing I can say, that for a decent person, this sentence is true. It is the definition of a decent person. Decent is a person, honest is a person, for whom this sentence is true, who considers this sentence is true, and who lives up to the sentence in his life about which he considers that the sentence is true. But I don't say that it is true that it's better to suffer than commit injustice. I say only that for those persons who accept it as true, these are the good persons. For good persons, the sentence is true. You can bring other interpretations as well. Kant's interpretation is about the order of maxim. That is, that when you follow the proper order of maxim, you are a decent person. You can make a case for this. That is, if there is a choice between this and that way of action, then you first do not decide whether it's harmful or useful, whether it is right or wrong in the practical respect. You first should find out whether it's decent or undecent, good or evil. And only if you come to the conclusion that it is good or it is morally indifferent, then you can ask the question whether is useful or harmful, whether it promises success or does not, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. This is also a very important definition. Good is the person who first wants to find out whether an action before him is good or bad, evil, and only after he is uncertain, it is rather good or it is morally indifferent, then he will ask the question whether it is useful or harmful, pleasant or unpleasant. I think it's a very simple, you can always answer this question. So we know who is the good person for whom these sentences are true. He's a decent person who has chosen himself under the category of the universal and becomes what he is, namely a decent person. And this person will ask, however, a following question, because we never know what is just and what is unjust. There is no certainty here. So he will ask the question, what is the right thing for me to do in this situation, in this position? This will ask the question. Wait a minute, only decent persons ask this question. When you start with the question, what is the right thing for me to do? Then this is the first thing a person asks, not what is useful for me to do, not what is pleasant for me to do, but I know anyhow Kant was right, but what is the right thing for me to do? If he is already a decent person, because people address you with this question only if they want to do the right thing, if they want to become what they are anyway, namely they want to develop their own personality towards the telos of their personality, they want to become what they are, namely decent person. Then you ask the question, what is the right thing for me to do? The answer to the question is sometimes very vague. There are persons with wonderful intuition. You see, there is such a thing as moral talent, everyone knows. There are people who have a feel for what is the right thing for them to do. They don't even need to ask the question. Almost always unfailingly, they will do the right thing. But mostly we are not born with moral talents. We are not virtuosi of morality, as Max Weber has called them. We are virtuosi of morality. We are not necessarily virtuosi of morality. So we need crutches. We have to rely upon something. We can rely on the mention, on the categorical imperative, on Socrates. We can rely on moral philosophies. We can rely on many things when we want to find out what is the right thing for us to do. We can rely on the advice of a friend. We can rely also on the advice of a teacher. We can turn to people and ask people or systems or whatever, no, give me an answer, give me an advice. What is the right thing for me to do here and now? The asking the question and obeying and following the advice is typical for a decent person. He can get the better advice. He can have a bad intuition. There is no decent person who wouldn't have ever done something indecent. And this is when Hannah Arendt answers, yes, it happens all the time, but since you know if you are decent, that you did something which is not decent, you know that in this case you did become something else, what you are, that's dirt, you are dirty, that's not clean, then you ask for forgiveness. Then you ask for forgiveness, you ask for pardon, you want the other to forget and to forgive. And you can put yourself right into the proper situation to become again what you are, because you can regret if you have done something wrong. Now, if you haven't chosen yourself a decent person, you do not know that you have done something wrong. Now, everyone outside you says that you ought to kill, as Himmler said to the SS, please control your natural feeling of empathy, because a decent person does not empathize. You ought to learn to kill. Yeah? This is basically when you get the advice. You can get such a terrible advice if you are not a decent person. But of course, if you ought to kill, you are a person who rather does the wrong than to suffer the wrong. So it does not fit to any category of the choice, self-choice of a decent person. Obviously, if others choose for you, they can choose anything for you. But if you choose for yourself, you determine yourself, then you ask the right question, even if sometimes you get the wrong answers, because the situation is difficult, because you do not interpret the situation or the other person rightly, you can always do the wrong thing. In fact, you can also happen to be in a situation of moral conflict, ethical conflict, something that Immanuel Kant hasn't accepted, but it exists, then you can choose only the good if you choose also the bad. In the case of moral conflicts, real moral conflicts, this very frequently happens, at least in borderline situation, if no moral other situation. So let's return now to the first pillar of modernity. The first pillar of modernity is the decent man. Because when you choose yourself, you fund yourself. This is a foundation. But this is not a foundation which is individualistic. Because listen to Socrates. It is, I rather suffer wrong than wrong another person. That is the ethical norm on the ground of which I choose myself. It's my relationship to the other. It's not my relationship to myself. It's always the relationship to the other. That is the whole, my choice of my decency is determined through my relationship to the other. That is, I rather it never says, I should suffer, would be stupid. But he says, in the case you wrong another, or you are wrong, you rather choose to be wrong than to wrong another. That is the whole moral elementary situation of decent person. It's an interpersonal situation. It is always your relationship to the other which is at stake. You take responsibility for yourself becoming what you are. By this you take responsibility to your relationship to your fellow creatures, to other persons, and through this you take responsibility for the other. I would not say for all persons. Sometimes it is said for all persons, you take responsibility for the whole world. I think it is too much. We don't take responsibility for the whole world. I tell you why not. Because I say that I rather suffer than commit the wrong. And I can say that only in the case if I am in the position to do wrong, to wrong another person. I cannot say that if I'm not in a position to wrong anyone. I cannot wrong a person who lives from me 5,000 kilometers away, whom I never in my life met. Yeah? So it makes no sense. The person with whom I have this moral relationship needs to be in my action radius, directly or indirectly. People towards whom I can behave in the way that I can wrong him, or rather not to wrong him, rather wrong myself. Now this is basically the foundation of the good person. That's the first pillar, one of the pillars of the modern pillar of modern ethics. No, I think that good persons exist, and if they are good persons, they are good persons because they have chosen themselves as good persons through the leap. Because otherwise, they would be fundamentalists, otherwise they would follow only the norms and rules of a little community, otherwise they would always listen to the others in their community, and they would not become decent persons. If someone is decent, if someone is honest and good, then you can assume that the person has chosen himself as a decent person. It is a metaphor, but not only a metaphor. Because, for example, we have from the literature, and also for personal experiences, a lot of examples about persons who know exactly when they have chosen as a decent person. I know about the person who told me the story about torturing the cat, that when he was torturing a cat, then he has chosen himself as a decent person. He said, never ever, never ever, never ever. I don't want to feel this pangs of conscience. Never ever again. So you sometimes you know exactly that that's the moment in your life. Sometimes you do not know. You have no idea. You just do it. So there is no proof that you have chosen yourself existentially. Being decent is the only proof. But I repeat, this is exactly what Kant said. There is no proof that someone obeys the categorical imperative. If your goodwill shines like a jewel, this is the only proof. So I think this is a very Kantian ethics, in fact, but a combination of Kant and Aristotle. Aristotle is the teleology, that inbuilt teleology, inbuilt telos. And it is a Kantian ethic in all other issues. It is basically, it distinguishes between transcendental and empirical. The choice of the self is on the level of transcendental. The leap is transcendental in a way, but it is not pure practical reason. It's not humankind in us. It is basically we choose ourselves. We do not choose humankind in us. Because humankind that has no world, humankind in fact never doesn't exist, so it's very difficult to choose humankind in ourselves. But let me now come, because time goes by, for the second pillar. The second pillar of which modern ethic rests is the constitution of liberties. So we talked about the two master narratives of Europe, I think it was yesterday, if I remember that. And I told you, we discussed this, that liberation is different from constitution of liberties. That different master narratives of liberation, and again different master narratives of the constitution of liberties, when we speak about the constitution, we are in the master narrative of Greek and Roman historiography and philosophy, that this is the model of constitution of liberties. This is the second pillar. And by the way, Hegel gave a very important indication here, that if liberties are constituted, that the case of constitution of liberties, which kind of rights should be always respected? He spoke about moral rights, and I have no objection against it. It's not about morality, but moral right, what he's talking about. He said that all constitution which we bring into being has to honor three rights of humans. And that's a modern idea. The first right which our constitution should honor is the right to pursue our own happiness. This, all constitution should honor this. The second moral right all constitution should honor is the right to develop our abilities, our best abilities. The third moral right every constitution should honor is that everyone has the right to his or her own conception of the good. Now, we spoke about the third, because the whole problem of choosing ourselves as a decent person, that is the first pillar of modern ethics, it is based on the presupposition that each has the right to choose the moral good of his own. That's the plurality, that's the moral plurality of the modern world. But Hegel says the constitution itself, and it's not just constitution, but the whole Sittlichkeit, the whole institutional world, whole institution has to respect these three moral rights. It has to be inbuilt in the institutionalized world, and this is why it has to be there in the constitution of liberties. The constitution of liberties, I do not speak about all aspects of it, I want to simplify a little bit this problem, but as the term suggests, the constitution of liberties is a constitution, it is constituted, it is man-made. In the way we choose ourselves, we address our own envelope, so we address our own envelope as citizens as well. The sum total of the citizen constitutes liberties together, that we constitute our own liberties. They are also chosen. In fact, they are constituted. We make the constitution as we address our envelope. This is basically, they are very parallel. That is the constitution of liberties and the constitution, and the choice of myself during the life is very modern. What does it mean to constitute liberties? What does it mean? You constitute liberties, you draw a constitution. The constitution is drawn by the founding father, and it is presumed that it embodies the conception of all citizens, that we, the people, constitute liberties. We, the people, we are the one who constitute these liberties. Make a constitution which is the fundamental law. Now, wait a minute. Fundamental law, Grundgesetz, says the German. It means it is founding. It is founding. That's why it's Grundgesetz, it's the fundamental law. And the word suggests you do here with a fundament. As you do with a fundament when you choose yourself, because you found yourself, you are the one who address your own envelope. Here you also found the city, that is the foundation of the city. We speak about the founding fathers in America. Founding fathers, this has two meanings. That is, the foundation is not God-given. It's not just there. It is not the natural foundation. We are the founders. The founding fathers formulate. They are the founders. But it is a foundation. It is a ground. It's the ground to which we can always return. We have to return to it. All law has to return to it. Nothing should contradict this foundation, which means it's an arche in the Aristotelian sense of the word arche, that not all arguments, but all laws, which are also arguments, have to return to this foundation. They should not contradict the foundation. The foundation can be amended, because we are modern persons. It's not God-given. We can amend the foundation, but the foundation is and remains the foundation. Nothing should contradict the foundation. This is why it is a foundation. This is why it is the arche of all of our arguments. We constitute a constitution. The American Declaration of Independence very beautifully formulates, very wisely formulates the preconditions of the act of foundation. He said, we held this truth to be self-evident. Listen to this wisely formulated sentence. We hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men are born free. We hold this truth to be self-evident. The sentence is wonderfully formulated because it consciously formulates a contradiction. Because if there is a truth, it is self-evident. Every truth is self-evident. But what does it mean? We call this truth as self-evident. Because the truth is as a self-evident. We. That is, we take responsibility for it. We take responsibility. We, the founding father, takes responsibility of that it is self-evident that all men are born free. I already told you that it's not self-evident. All men are born free is a sentence which makes no sense. Then when you say we hold this truth to be self-evident, it means that the sentences all men are born free and are equally endowed by God with reason and conscience and equal right to liberty and etc., etc., equality and the pursuit of happiness. It means that from this moment on, we take this truth as self-evident. It is self-evident for us, we call them self-evident, and because we call it as self-evident, it is true for whom? It is true for everyone who signs the Constitution. In principle, it is presupposed every citizen is a signatory of the Constitution. That's very best conception. In fact, with our signature, we testify that the sentence all men are born free is true. That is, we with our signature, we testify. We take the responsibility for this sentence. And this is the foundation. We are the foundation that we take responsibility for this very sentence. How can you take responsibility for this sentence? This is a sentence which basically is based on the truth that all men are born free. A truth which, however, is nonsensical as truth because it makes no sense. Obviously, you need to found the self-evident truth as well. What does it mean you found a self-evident truth? Basically, you start the argument ad infinitum. You ask the question, why are we entitled to say that all men are born free? Why don't we say, as all our ancestors said, that one is born free, the other is born slave? Why do we say that all men are born free? What makes us say that? And in this sense, the founding fathers return to a kind of tradition, to the tradition of natural rights, the tradition of natural rights on which they rely upon by accepting the truth of the sentence. And they do not go further. They do not ask further questions. Don't ask further questions, because then you have no foundation. You say, we accept it, it is a foundation, we sign it. Not every modern person signs it. In modernity, a lot of people do not sign it. For example, racists will never sign the sentence that all men are born free or equally endowed with reason and conscience. Why is that self-evident for a racist? It's just not self-evident at all. The question is self-evident for those who signed the sentence. Again, the gesture is the same. We, in a way, address the envelope. We address that. We take responsibility for it. We choose it. We take it as self-evident. We sign it. It is a fundamental law for those who sign it. That is, in the same way, it is for the person who chooses a sense of a decent person. He becomes what is. Decency is the foundation. So for only for those persons who sign as true sentence that all men are born free, will be the sentence that all men are born free true, will be the foundation of the Republic, and will have a kind of, would say, validity. Now, all signatories are fictitious. We speak about here about fictitious signatories. In fact, the contradiction between the Declaration of Independence, the American Constitution on the one hand, and the reality on the other hand, was far greater than the contradiction might be in the case of a person who chooses himself as a good person and still commits something which is indecent. In the latter case, you have to ask for forgiveness. In the first case, in the worst case, you have to change the laws. Now, all men are born free and equally endowed by God with reason and conscience was formulated in a country with slavery. Some were born slaves and others were born free. That how can you validate the sentence to change the laws? All men should be free. And basically the sentence means the following. It means the following. All men are born free, as Rousseau formulated, but they are everywhere in chains. That was Rousseau. He formulated that contradiction. But it means that all men ought to be. We have to treat all men as if all men were born free. It's an obligation. The signature is an obligation. It's obligation to treat all men as if all men were born free. It's obligation to create laws according to which all men would be born free. This is a very general foundation. This general foundation does not tell you anything about the images of men. Because if you legislate or you pursue a kind of politics, you are not only referring to the foundation of a constitution, you also suggest certain political avenues or agendas on the ground of your images of men. And in the modern world, there are certainly very different images of men. All movements or parties or institutions with different images of men must, however, formulate their conceptions and their suggestions in a way that it should not contradict the Constitution, because this is a foundation. At least three typical images of men in the modern world. One is created by conservatism, the other is created by socialism, the third is created by liberalism. There are three entirely different images of men. And they have different policies, different conceptions, but they are presupposed that all equally will sign the Constitution. There is a common feature between these two pillars, although they are not necessarily related. We cannot assume that all decent persons are good citizens. There might be a decent person who never participates in public life. We cannot necessarily assume that every decent citizen takes the foundation seriously. We really believe that all men are born free, will be also a decent person. So Aristotle already said that's only in an ideal case that good men are good citizens. They can be also different. The problem is not that they should be the same person. The problem is that modern ethics, we can speak about modern ethics, about the stability of modern ethics if these two pillars stand. If modernity and modern society is founded on these two pillars. Of course, they are only pillars. And as all pillars, all houses which stand on pillars, there is a fragility. The pillars can be shaken. The house can collapse. And this means that I mean this seriously, because the pillars can be shaken, the house can any time collapse. You do not know how long this house stands. Only Bhakti can know that as long as these pillars remain intact, the house is going to stand. So humans are like Atlas. They carry the modern world on their shoulder, because humans take responsibility both for the constitution and for themselves. And that every person has need to have the power or the strength of an Atlas and carry the world on their shoulder. There are persons who tell nowadays that our world is worse than any possible world, that we are living in the world of nihilism, that we do not make a distinction between good and evil anymore, that it's a totally immoral world which is doomed to self-destruction. I don't think this is the case. I think from what I said, you will see that I don't think that it is indeed the case. But I would not deny that this is a possibility. Not the case, but the possibility. So this is why I told you this story about the two pillars of modern ethics, to see that the world is not yet the world of nihilism, and I think it's very much overdone when we speak about the total nihilism of the present day with a kind of, I will say, badly conceived Nietzscheanism. But I would not say that it is not a pending danger, that these two pillars are too fragile, and they can be shaken. So what is not actuality is still a possibility, which I hope won't be true. Thank you very much. I again overstepped my time, as usual. Again, excuse me. Again, longer. I see, talk always longer than it would be necessary. Yes.
I have a question for the second part of your lecture about the citizens, about the constitution. And I would ask you to complete a little bit more about the foundation of constitution and natural law. But I will explain what I mean. And for instance, the German Constitution, the first sentence of the German Constitution says the dignity of human beings is unantastable. The Goethe is mentioned as unantastable. The sentence which is historically quite obvious is the question. But it's a strongly in natural law founded sentence. It's another thing to say that the dignity of human beings are untouchable, or to say we consider, as you would not call it. And I would like to ask you, what do you think about a strong foundation of constitution in natural law? Because if you, for example, refer to the German history, the first German constitution was a nearly a contractualist constitution. Mm-hmm. And we have seen what was the result. It was so weak that the rise of national socialism was no problem. And so the answer in the next generation was to make a constitution which no one can put out of.
Such a constitution doesn't exist, because constitution is valid as long as the citizens support it.
Yes, this is what I want to ask you. What happens if we no longer call human beings to be? This is the alternative point, saying dignity of human being is untouchable. No one at any time can touch human dignity. What you all only can legitimate by natural law as should grow up here and there, you only can legitimate by natural law. I have a problem with this natural law, but historically I can see that it may be necessary. And so it's partly that what I was called fascist patriotism, patriotism of constitution, I agree with that. But and I agree with the first sentence of my constitution. But I have my problems with a foundation in natural law. But so this is a paradox, this is a problem. And I would only ask you to, what do you think about that problem?
The constitution is constituted that it is supported by the citizen, and if they withdraw the signature, then the constitution is nothing. Constitution lives and is a foundation as long as it is signed. If it does no more sign, then the building collapses, and you get fundamentalism. You get totalitarianism, you get something else, but you won't have a republic with a constitution. Now wait a minute, I go back to your question. I don't think that natural law, I think natural rights theories are, well, they don't return to natural law, they return to natural rights theories. And this is not just about the Constitution, because not just the Constitution is in a way supported by natural rights theory, but the so-called human right. The human right, which is not in a constitution, because the human right is not a citizen's right, can be validated only on the ground of natural rights theories and not on natural law theories. So I think it's a little bit a shift here. Strauss wrote a book about it and natural right and history. But it's very interesting, however, that the problem of dignity, the word dignity, gets into the modern constitution. It has a historical background, not just a natural rights theories, but it's a controversy with the feudal constitutions, quasi-constitutions, even a constitution, but the feudal legal system. Because there are two basic categories. One category is honor, and the other category is dignity. See Shakespeare, honor and dignity, or see Montaigne, great man who knew what is the difference between honor and dignity. Honor is the category of monarchy, dignity is the category of the republic. And this is basically, that's why dignity is so, I always emphasize that we are a republic. It's a republican thing. You know, the honor of persons are guaranteed. The dignity of the person is guaranteed. Because honor has something which has an aristocratic touch, and dignity was a polemic conception against honor. It is the republican conception. So when you say that the dignity of men will absolutely protect that, then you do not speak only about the single individual and his protection, but you speak about republicanism, because this is a slogan of the republic. In republic, every citizen has a dignity, and not honor, they have dignity, and as a citizen. So I think it's a very strong republicanist conception. How you interpret this dignity? And in the case of concrete laws and conflicts, and there are conflicts, that certain laws are in conflict not with the Constitution but with each other, and then you can refer to different parts of the Constitution, because this refers to dignity, the other refers to another aspect of Constitution. There can be interpretation of the Constitution can come to these contradictions. But I think it is very relevant, precisely because it is traditionally a republican thing, dignity, to speak in a modern constitution not about honor, but about dignity. It's constitutions, although you constitute them, the terminology of a constitution is of course embedded in a discourse. And this was the discourse of the time of enlightenment, honor and dignity. That's why I said Montesquieu, who clarified this beautifully. That is, discourse goes into the constitution making. Which one? You? I don't know who was first.
And my question is, well understood that I do agree with all what you have explained about self-choice, How can we articulate all that theory of choices, as I said, I'm going it, with the fact of social injustice, with the fact of a very big difference in income or work or possibilities? I mean, to which extent a person born in a very poor environment, because of a poor family or poor country, could choose herself as a prime minister? I mean, it is true that the difference in possibilities, how would we articulate the fact of differences or the fact of inequal distribution of means of living?
Do you think that only wealthy people can be decent? That's my question. Do you think that only wealthy people can be good?
No,
because I think that there is an equal opportunity to choose yourself a decent person, whether you're poor or rich. And that does not depend on it, and wherever you are. Some people say, Christ said just the opposite. Yeah, only poor can get into the kingdom of heaven. And you can, at both ways, but I think there is no difference. You can choose yourself a decent person under all circumstances, and you, rich and poor equally so. It's not, I don't think that the rich cannot get into the kingdom of heaven, but I don't think they think that the poor cannot get into the kingdom of heaven. All can get, all can choose themselves decently.
You have explained that we choose everything. I mean, we choose, it's very clear the difference between being a decent person or a good person. But if I choose to be a philosopher, or if I choose to be, I mean, all the examples that you have mentioned, I should be able to choose in the same way to be a prime minister. And I haven't got the same opportunities in case that I am poor, but I would like to do the example of the ballet. But if you have put the prime minister in Brazil,
but I do not choose myself as a prime minister. I do not choose myself as a prime minister. I do not choose myself as a university professor. I choose myself, even the first case, under the category of difference, which is far more problematic than choosing myself as a decent person, which is available for everyone. But if I choose myself under the category of difference, I do not choose myself as a prime minister. I do not choose myself as a university professor. I choose myself as a philosopher. I choose myself as a person who heals, that as I can be a doctor, as I can be a healing person. I choose myself as such and such, but not as a concrete. I don't choose an occupation. Even under the difference, I don't choose something, I choose myself. But even if you're choosing something, I think people do that nowadays. It's very funny, because although there is no equal opportunity, there is the idea of equal opportunity, and people believe in the idea of equal opportunity, and they believe that what is in fact an equal opportunity is an anomaly. Now, in pre-modern times, unequal opportunity was the law, and equal opportunity was a stupidity. No one believed in it. Now, if we believe in equal opportunity, and it is unequal, it's an anomaly. But I was once in the Fiji Island. You know the Fiji is a small island. And in a Methodist church, and after I was visiting school children, and asked the little girls from Fiji Island, what do you want to become when you become an adult? One girl said, I want to be a pilot. The other said, I want to be a doctor. And the third said, I want to have a hotel, an owner of the hotel. The question is not whether they will become this. The question is the imagination is there. The imagination. The imagination makes it possible. I would not say it is necessary, but it makes possible to choose myself also under the category of difference. Today it is possible. And it does not mean that the choice under the category of difference is more fragile than under the category of goodness or decency, because I said it's universal. Everyone can become what he or she has chosen himself to be. In the case of choice under the category of difference, there may be failures, there may be impossibilities, and you are right that it is more fragile choosing myself under the category of difference. It is far more fragile. And in this case, it's not your mistake if other choose for you and you cannot choose for yourself. It's possible.
Okay.
Yeah.
What I probably should do, the first line is that in this situation of belief, I would like to point out that
I don't understand.
I would like to point out the fact that after Freud and the theory of the psychoanalysis, well, we know that it has been seriously criticized, but anyway, the notion of unconscious is more or less accepted. So, how can we really choose our traumas? I mean, how can we really choose what we resolve? Maybe because it's in the region of our mind that we do not have any access. This is my question. And the other one is a really very great and very short. What do you think about the situations of exception? Situations in which the Republic has to cancel its principles in order to save the state, for example.
The first question, psychoanalytical question. Of course, we have no access to our unconscious, and we have no access to our traumas. You can say, and you choose yourself, you say, I choose my traumas, I choose my unconscious. You can choose what you do not know as well, and become what you are. Can I tell you a story? And the story is a real story, because it happened in a Budapest mental asylum. There was a catatonic person, somebody who hasn't spoken one single word for 2 years. And there was a murderer who was for one night in the same cell together with this catatonic person. And the murderer told the catatonic person that he's going to kill the doctor, and he pulled out the knife. And the doctor opened the door. In this moment, the catatonic person started to shout, "Take care, take care, take care, he will kill you." After 2 years, that was the first sentence he said. And then he hasn't said any word further. Which means the man was so good that he overcame the catatonic situation to save the doctor's life. That's a real story. That's a real story. We mean that you can choose in your unconscious, you can choose that it comes out in this fantastic situation. It was a fantastic because you fall back and hasn't said one single word after us, only shouting. Take care, Tekka. He's going to kill you. What do you say about this?
It's an example.
That's a story. But truly neurotic persons, even depressive persons, depression on any psychology does not determine morality. And this I mean seriously without stories. Psychology does not determine, because then we are back with the pulling of the strings. And you say, okay, it's not external because my psychology determines my morality. But it is not the case. My uncle, even Freud would speak about that, about the superego, that your S does not determine your morality. And even the traditional psychoanalysts will tell you that morality is not determined by your unconscious. It can be far more difficult. Far more difficult, that's not impossible.
Yeah, but the point here, if morality can be reduced to natural laws, external laws, and at the same time to laws of psychology, because then morality would exist as itself, as morality. So I understand this, that for example, in Kant, in order to say freedom or liberty, then there is this transcendence of freedom, because in laws of nature, in the world, in the empirical world, these laws, they operate. So he has to to say that there is a region at the center of region, different in any case, and where these laws doesn't work, in order to do that, to postulate the principle of freedom. But in the way, in your terminology, I
I think that it is an experience, and experiences are always experiences in the world, because we cannot have an experience of the transcendental and Kant's terminology, for example. So then maybe there is a here a problem, because I agree with you. I think morality and ethics, it's important to work with this issue, not to be reduced to laws of nature and so on. But there are some problems with this, because three of these choices, they are these experiences.
I see two different things in your. I don't know how natural laws get into the business, because they have nothing to do with morality. But because even psychological events and traumas are not described as natural law, in no psychoanalytic school they are treated as such. So I forget about everything that natural law is concerned. Of course, the psychological constitution of persons is different. And the existential choice presupposes that you choose your own psychology, you choose your own traumas, and as you are, you are a decent person. Obviously, it's not equally easy or equally difficult to become what you have chosen yourself to be. For a person with a fragile psychological outfit, it's extremely difficult. And for a person who is easygoing and who has a happy world, to return to the first lecture, it is far easier to become what he has chosen himself to be. I only said it's not impossible, but it can be very difficult. And I speak about ethics, when I speak about the pillar of modern ethics. And I haven't referred to psychology, because psychology are quite different, and I presuppose that on the ground of every psychology, in case if there is nothing in your psychology, it would be impossible for you to make any kind of free choice, even for yourself, that's possible, there is such a case, then all psychologically endowed people are able to live up to the choice of themselves. But obviously, it's not equally easy and not equally difficult, and if the choice of the self itself is impossible, then of course they are not going to choose themselves. And because they will be unable, I don't think that everyone can choose oneself, and even if he could, he won't do it. Yeah, most people who are very healthy and very happy won't choose themselves as a decent person, though there are no psychological obstacles for doing this. Shakespeare is full with this kind of problems. And in Shakespeare, you see, a person who chooses himself a decent person but is at the same time neurotically melancholic chooses to keep himself away from human company, like Jacques, for example. Because you can choose a way of life in which you remain true to your choice, and you do not endanger your choice. But you don't go back to the royal court, because you know that in the royal court you cannot remain true to yourself. You remain outside, you remain in the woods. Because in the woods you will remain true to yourself. You know that you are deeply depressive character. So you can choose a form of life in which you can live up better to your chosen character. In Shakespeare you can have a lot of examples for that.
My questions, two questions, and they're both about the first pillar. I guess, having heard this and talked